Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest is Andrew Colin. Andrew is professor of political science at Hilbert College. His books include State Power and Democracy, State Structure and Genocide. Andrew has been on before. There is never a shortage of topics to discuss. I'm sure Andrew would agree on that. I hope one of them Andrew has on his mind today is Egypt. We certainly should mention something about what's going on. It's a little bit of a quiet day in Egypt today. Well, I should hold that comment, Andrew, because the latest I saw in a report that I keep writing about Egypt, Andrew. I want to let you jump in, but I've written many articles on Egypt. It began with events leading up to the ouster of Mubarak in February 2011. It literally took 18 days to get rid of the guy. He was a dictator for 30 years. It only happened. It wasn't because of the Egyptian people wanting him out. It was because America wanted him out. But you never read about that in the New York Times or heard it on CNN or anything else. Anyway, he's gone. But the ruling authority wants Mubarakism back. So I have a new article I'll put out tomorrow called Mubarakism 2.0. The Islamists are out. The junta is back in power. Well, it always was in power. If civilian officials, whether they're elected or otherwise, serve at their pleasure. But I must say, as less than perfect the election was that made Mohamed Morsi president of Egypt, it certainly was the most democratic event probably in Egypt's history. I can't imagine anything that was more democratic, but it had a long way to go. Nonetheless, he's out. He's under house arrest. He's in an undisclosed location. There's been extreme violence. Happened before what I call Bloody Wednesday, followed by Bloody Friday. Today could have been Bloody Sunday, but demonstrations were called off, at least according to the latest report I saw. I don't think they're called off entirely because the Muslim Brotherhood wants daily demonstrations. They're very, very upset, and they should be, that their leader was ousted by a coup. It was a coup. There's no question about that. Washington doesn't call it that. John Kerry calls it the way to restore democracy in Egypt. I think John Kerry needs his ears boxed. Maybe he needs his eyes and ears cleaned out. I don't know, Andrew, but let me let you jump in. And I know you have things in your mind you want to discuss.
Sure. I guess we could start with Egypt and migrate to any number of other issues. There's a whole lot on the plate. But let me just kind of piggyback on what you're saying about Egypt and tie it to where I would like to take at least some of the discussion. We see events in Europe as really, to me, an indication of what U.S. foreign policy is really about, and that the U.S. certainly is not willing to accept in Egypt, as it has elsewhere, without getting into any number of numerous examples, democratic movements on their own, that the U.S. will either up front or behind the scenes will support these oppressive regimes in order for the U.S. to extend its control globally, either to make the world model itself after what the U.S. would like to see its version of democracy, and as well as further its economic interests. And of course, I'm sure you're aware of this, as many of your listeners. To me, the most glaring fact of this is that the U.S. has been unwilling, which some people have at least called for, is to cut the $1.3 billion in military aid that Egypt currently receives. They certainly want to keep the U.S. military, the Egyptian military, on the side of the U.S. as a way to control Middle East politics and to certainly continue with the alliance, although it is kind of behind the scenes, of Egypt and Israel in setting and controlling oil prices against the euro dollar.
Oh, absolutely. I say all the time, Andrew, the last thing America wants is seeing democracy break out. And it's true abroad. It's true at home. America is in lockstep with some of the world's worst despots. The only thing America cares about are leaders of countries who are pro-Western, who toe the mark to the Washington agenda, what Washington says goes. And as long as our foreign leaders go along with that, it's fine. It doesn't matter if they're so-called Democrats or despots or anything in between. It's independent leaders that get the ire of America. They're the ones that get targeted for regime change.
Sure, but when we speak of democracy, let's focus a bit of our attention for the moment at the United States and look at the lack of democracy here. But what I want to do, and I think it would be certainly of interest to your listeners, that even though events in the United States seem to be negative, I would like to provide some somewhat positive possible directions for U.S. politics, and my focus here in particular is to look at what's also has been in the news now, a bit sidelined by events in Egypt, is what's been going on with the NSA and the whole issue of government secrecy. Now, if you look at what's been going on in the last few months, there's been exposure of NSA, the NSA surveillance program, which certainly obviously appeared to be very troubling. But if you look closely, what is going on with all those revelations? They tell us a lot about the lack of democracy in the United States in terms of three areas, which I'd like to talk about in just a little detail here. One being the inner workings of the NSA, which will get me in a few moments to what Edward Snowden is about. Second, how the NSA has been relating to other branches of government, in particular Congress. And the relation, thirdly, the NSA has had in relation to the American people. Now let's talk about Congress. And again, shifting from the negative to the positive, because I want to certainly talk about both in your program. We know, and again, this has been coming out more and more in the news, that there has been no effective, or I would, if I could change that, no real congressional oversight of the NSA. Members of Congress, without naming any number of names here, have freely admitted that they are unaware of the NSA surveillance program. And that even when a few members of Congress, such as Patrick Leahy and others, have requested documents or information, they were either ignored or denied. Now, another troubling aspect of the NSA is that all these various electronic technological devices that we have gotten so accustomed to using, such as the Internet and cellular telephones, etc., are all being monitored by a very sophisticated software program called X Key Score, it's called. So that whatever one does using any type of technology, any kind of, in fact, search you do, can easily be collected and has been collected by the NSA. And what I'm suggesting to your listeners and what you started to say at the top of the program, which indicates the lack of democracy, not just in terms of U.S. foreign policy, but at home, is I think we need to get at what is the institutional basis of that, looking at the NSA, and it's what I would call, and others have also referred to it as mission creep. That is, the NSA as an institution has continually sought over quite a few decades now, and they've been some interesting scholarly research on that the NSA has continually sought to expand its control in this dubious war called terrorism. Let me just mention one example of this mission creep, which shows that the NSA is not just solely in the business of going after so-called terrorists. What's recently come out is that the DEA, the drug agency, has made use of data collected through the NSA to seek to now convict Americans for various crimes, including drug offenses. Now, this is a secret process. This amounts to a search without cause or warrant, which remains, how do you say, removed from any kind of judicial review. Now, the next aspect of the NSA, certainly incredibly troubling, is that the NSA doesn't really monitor or track its own surveillance program. So there's no institutional checks in place within the NSA to determine whether or not any kind of abuse takes place. And then furthermore, which I want to discuss with you a little later about this issue of so-called legality of these leaks and the U.S. government saying what Manning and Snowden are doing is legal. Look at how the NSA has been given legal cover by simply going to the secret FISA court, which routinely renews, which amounts to illegal activities of the NSA. Now let's look at the executive branch, if you want to talk about undemocratic practices, the Obama administration. If you had noticed, Obama had made some interesting statements prior to going on vacation. He was talking about essentially telling the American people that we should just kind of suck it up and just accept the NSA surveillance program. And what he said, and I want to quote this to give you a sense of the mindset of the president and the ties between the NSA and the executive branch, he said, and I quote, "It's not enough for me as president to have confidence in the program. The American people need to have confidence in them as well," end of quote. Now, given the fact that the American people have no knowledge of the full extent of the surveillance program of the NSA, and given the fact that there is no oversight whatsoever by Congress, it is fairly disingenuous for the president to ask the American people to support the NSA surveillance program. What means is that how can one have any legal limits on such a program when there are no limits in terms of the extent and scope of NSA surveillance? Now, as I said at the start of your at the start of my comment, let's shift a bit from the negative to the positive. Is there any kind of, how do I put it, silver lining, anything positive that we could talk about in relation to all these exposures which amount to some very undemocratic domestic practices by the NSA? Let's go back to Congress. Interesting, as a result of the Edward Snowden leaks, members of Congress have now been quite busy in this area, which I do think, at least in, to some extent, is quite significant. We're starting to see an increasing number of bills in an effort to rein in the rather rampant spying of the NSA. Some of the bills are more effective than others. In fact, there's, last I saw, about over a dozen bills. Let me go from the weak to the strong bills. The weak bills we have is what is called the Ending Secret Law Act. This is sponsored by Jeff Meekley, Democrat of Oregon, and Representative Adam Schiff, Democrat California. Kind of weak. It just mandates disclosure, a summation of FISA court rulings on surveillance. We also have another bill, which is weak but somewhat noteworthy, is what's called the Government Surveillance Act of 2013, sponsored by Rich Laura, a Democrat of Washington, which requires the government and corporate America to reveal statistics about their surveillance program. Now, from the weak to the more substantive, we have the sponsorship of a bill by Stephen Lynch, what's called the Telephone Surveillance Accountability Act of 2013, has a bit more teeth than the preceding bills, which compels disclosure with judicial oversight of any kind of surveillance done by NSA. Also, in accordance with the wording of the bill, as I understand it, the FBI would be required to submit a report to the Senate and House Intelligence Committee regarding any kind of metadata telephone searches. Now, I could go on and on, but I just want to mention a few others which are of interest, but point to what I call a bit more of a positive response to all this negative news about the NSA. There's an interesting bill by the independent/socialist Senator Bernie Sanders. It's called Restore Our Privacy Act. This is kind of comprehensive in that the bill would place limits to surveillance and would specify how the FBI should be able to investigate what it considers to be terrorism and to place any kind of legal limits through judicial review. Okay, but finally, I just want to conclude with Congress and end with one of the most far-reaching is the one proposed by a Democrat from New Jersey, Representative Rush Holt, called the Surveillance State Repeal Act. How far it will go, I don't know, but to me, again, this is a positive indication. In essence, the Surveillance Repeal Act would repeal the Patriot Act as well as the rather draconian 2008 FISA amendments. So that, in a nutshell, is, again, what I would call the pushback, or if I can borrow from the CIA, blowback against the overreaching negative aspects of NSA. And I could talk about the individuals as we discuss other aspects later.
Well, you certainly touched on a lot of things that I've addressed in my writing. I've written many, many articles on NSA spying. I put out a new one this morning. I put out another one the day before. I'm sure I'm going to do more. There's so much about this story, and, of course, it relates to Edward Snowden, who, of course, is in Russia. At least I think he's there. He's not in Moscow, I understand. Yeah. I don't know where he is. He's keeping his location pretty much close to the vest, which he should. But if he thinks he's going to escape scrutiny by CIA and NSA, of course, he understands there's no place to hide, Andrew. I mean, these guys know how to dig stuff up. I don't know how he communicates. He tries to do it with encrypted messages. Maybe he's got... I don't have this kind of equipment. I don't have it on emails. I have nothing other than an ordinary telephone. So I don't know anything about this fancy technology, but I'm sure that NSA has a way of breaking through in some way, and CIA folks are operating everywhere. So he knows he has no place to hide. He realizes that. Anyway, he's there. But it's a very, very serious situation where literally America already is a police state. It's just being hardened more, and the idea that NSA and CIA, only two of America's known 16 spy agencies. Maybe there are others we never heard of. But I wrote an article about the Defense Intelligence Agency that's beefing up its structure abroad. But the DIA operates on a global basis, and I suggested possibly they'll even operate domestically. Why not? Global certainly includes America, includes North America, it includes America itself. So DIA, they want to double the number of their operators. They use different terms. I forget the terms I used in my article, but they use different terms, collectors, operators, people doing different kinds of things, but they're basically like CIA agents doing with different functions, operating in different parts of the world, and they can pose either as businessmen, as attachés in embassies, same kind of stuff that CIA does. So in NSA, of course, they use technology. I don't think they have people roam the world. They're in various facilities that NSA operates, but it's a pretty serious situation. I wrote about institutionalized spying a long time ago, Andrew, but Snowden was very, very important because he connected important dots for millions of people who either knew very little or they knew nothing. Now they know something.
It's very interesting you raise that, and I do want to get to our discussion to talk about Bradley Manning and Edward Snowden, and certainly I think the American public is getting a bit ahead of the government, which again I feel positive about. Just a couple of polls I've seen that the majority of Americans consider him a whistleblower and not a traitor. But let's talk a bit about Manning, since again he's also been in the news. To talk about, and again, this in its own indirect way gets us back to Egypt, is we don't have to look overseas to see what U.S. foreign policy is doing and its unwillingness to accept democracy overseas. What it raises domestically, and this to me is essential to understanding Manning, Snowden, and even WikiLeaks, is how the U.S. government arbitrarily decides to make exceptions to law, that it decides what legality is, and even though its own actions are illegal, which takes us to Bradley Manning and the overall, I would say, fair conclusion to his trial. But if you look at the whole angle of the prosecution charge in pursuit of the so-called terrorist angle, Manning was fundamentally accused of aiding the enemy with violation of the antiquated 1917 Espionage Act, and they threw in for good measure computer fraud, embezzlement of government property. But even though he was acquitted of the aiding the enemy charge, what the prosecution was trying to send, which I think will backfire, is a message to silence political dissent. Now, I find one thing very interesting before I even talk about, not to get off on a tangent, about Bradley Manning and Snowden, which to me raises hope about this this generation. If you look at, these are people in their 20s and early 30s, Snowden and Manning, who are coming forth, that there is a kind of awareness of that generation that they don't want to live this way. They don't want to have all their phone messages and internet. But let's get back to the Manning trial, that I would argue that what Manning did was quite legal. And I want to spend just a couple moments and talk about that, that the government is really acting illegal and not Manning. In fact, Manning had an acute awareness of certain principles of law. Just to, again, I'm sure your listeners are aware of this, but what Manning did release was something quite significant, which we know as the collateral damage video. This collateral damage video contains some awful footage of U.S. helicopters killing 12 Iraqi civilians in 2007. Now, Manning was aware of this, and he was acting legally in compliance to provisions of the Geneva Convention. In particular, Article 85. Now, just to mention briefly Article 85, Article 85 of the Geneva Convention prohibits attacks on civilians. So what the military was doing in Iraq was a grave breach of international law. But let's put aside the Geneva Conventions just for a moment. Given that Bradley Manning is in the military, he is supposed to act in accordance to the Army Field Manual, which he did, especially Section 499. 499 of the Field Manual refers to the Basic Law of War, and this, in essence, is a provision against soldiers committing war crimes. So Manning had, in accordance to Article 499, a legal obligation to report war crimes. So again, he's well acting within the law. But let me just briefly return to Article 3 of the Geneva Convention. This refers to care of the wounded. Now, this could take us off in another very interesting direction if we start to talk about the extensive use of drones. But the use of drones is a violation of this provision of the treaty, how the military had used them. The fact is that Manning testified that he reported the use of drones against civilians, and increasingly, which it is a shame the media never reported this, but he reported these various attacks on civilians by drones up the chain of command, but his superiors refused to take action. Now, one other aspect of Manning in terms of legality here as a soldier in the armed forces, he is supposed to comply with what's called the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Now, what I refer to, which is important in the case of Manning, contained in the Uniform Code of Military Justice, is a provision that soldiers have an obligation to not to follow unlawful orders. So Manning, in a sense, had a duty to reveal what was going on, what the military was doing, to report what he considered to be evidence of war crimes. Now, not only did Manning reveal war crimes such as the collateral murder video, he spoke what I call truth to power. He exposed, like Snowden did in various public statements, which contradicts actions which were done in secret. The point of the matter is, which again, this ties certainly Manning and Snowden, is the extent to which U.S. foreign policy, and now Egypt is coming back to this, is aggressive. It's based on the ongoing exercise of military might. And here again, we have the U.S. government deciding arbitrarily what is legal and what is illegal. Not just the secret drone wars overseas, but interestingly, which is probably, I regret to say, Hillary Clinton's in the running for 2016, Hillary Clinton gave orders to U.S. diplomats to spy on their counterparts. Now, what we talk about Edward Snowden, since that came up at the top of the program, Edward Snowden was, in essence, exposing the truth, which the government was seeking to hide. He was exposing the bureaucratic functions of an ongoing national security state that uses extreme secrecy in the name of confronting terrorism. But instead, what was Snowden bringing forth? That the NSA was simply trying to expand its power, to use data collection, and to be, simply in Orwellian terms, thought police. But most of all, which is troubling, and this is showing up in the polling and why members of Congress are proposing all these bills, there's no real objective standard to gather data. It is simply a matter of middle, even sometimes low-level officials in the NSA who decide arbitrarily who to spy on. Now, further evidence of this is the existence of what I mentioned a few moments ago of the X Key Score program of the NSA, which simply sucks up, which taps into all material from the Internet. Now, I'm saying that Snowden presented something very interesting, and that is, as far as I'm concerned, that there is a gulf between what the U.S. government says is legal and what's supposed to be in the U.S. Constitution, and how government officials, the Obama administration, can decide to make exceptions to the rule of law. So here we have an NSA which is gathering telephone records of every Verizon customer, including local calls, which has forged a secret agreement with all the telecons. So now most Americans don't have any kind of privacy whatsoever, since the NSA has access on a daily basis to everyone's phone records through what's called the PRISM program, and they have access to anything and everything we do through the Internet. Now, finally, what I want to say about Snowden is that his release of documents was never intended to jeopardize the security or names of agents overseas. None of that was ever revealed. All what Snowden had done, and I could say the same for Manning, is to expose the excessive secrecy and the deception practiced on the part of the government. Now, one could say the same about Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. They, if you look at the thousands upon thousands of documents now that are coming forth, here again we see an exposure of the deception, certainly of the war in Afghanistan, with all the cover-ups, with all the secret assassinations, the killings of civilians, all being released by WikiLeaks. But I would say that one should think of WikiLeaks in a way that perhaps it isn't often thought of as a news source. It's advocating as a media entity for a free press, unconnected to corporate control. So I am saying that if one assaults WikiLeaks, you are assaulting free speech. Now, think of, in any great detail, which I don't want to take up more time on your program, what WikiLeaks has exposed, it's quite astounding. It shows the deception on the part practiced by this government. But let me try to tie all this together, bring together...
Andrew, let me interrupt. Hold your thought. We need to take a short break.
Sure.
We'll do that. We'll come back, and then you pick up where you left off.
Sure.
Welcome back. Talking with Andrew Kolin, Egypt, NSA spying, NSA, Edward Snowden, Julian Assange. Andrew, pick up where you left off.
Sure. Prior to the break, I was discussing what Manning and Snowden and Assange WikiLeaks represent. I'd like to kind of tie them all together and show that there is a kind of commonality, that they all share common characteristics. What I would like to say first, just a few general comments and then get into some of the particulars in terms of their commonality. What I suggest overall, what they share in common is their exposure of the deception, excessive secrecy of the U.S. government, that I think is most important in general terms, that they have exposed the facade that the U.S. government is waging a war on terrorism, but beneath this facade, the U.S. government is waging an ongoing assault on dissent, civil disobedience, and those who seek to speak what I call truth to power, that the NSA exists, all these programs exist, and the monitoring of people's thoughts is to ferret out, to create some type of arbitrary criteria to identify viewpoints that the U.S. government simply does not like, and to simply silence diverse viewpoints. Now, let me proceed from these general comments to particular comments, what these three individuals share in common. They all share in common, I would argue, that to seek to protect, as the U.S. government has alleged, that extreme secrecy, the NSA, the actions of the government, that they are, that the NSA is protecting the United States from threats is a cover to mask the concentration of power and control within a very specialized branch of government. In other words, I'm suggesting in their own different way they are bringing more to light some of the inner workings of a national security state. Another particular aspect I argue that these three individuals share in common is that they have uncovered to a limited extent the actions taken by the U.S. government, how the actions taken violate national and international law. I mentioned this in passing with Bradley Manning, that he was trying to act within the law. Also, I suggest that these three individuals are in their own way offering a challenge to the idea of an ongoing terrorist threat is, in to some extent, being overblown and manufactured, that the government is simply using the terrorist threat to further concentrate power within the national security state. Another particular aspect that these three individuals share together, which I've made mention of and I want to briefly return to, is that the U.S. government is contradictory in its use of law. And I think that is most important, that they have, certainly the government has, in seeking to, for instance, prosecute Manning on very dubious charges, they have in many ways gone outside the law, raising charges against him that do not have really legal standing in a regular court of law. As well as if you start to look at, which certainly will be ongoing, the government's efforts to get a hold of and one day, who knows, seize Snowden and Assange using various threats and already assuming without any court of law rendering a judgment that they are already guilty. Now, also that these three individuals have clearly pointed out some rather glaring violations of national and international law, and that they are, what I'm suggesting is that the real violation of national and international law is not done by these three individuals, but by the failure of this administration to prosecute what I would certainly identify as the real violators of international law, the former Bush administration officials. And two other particulars I want to bring to the attention of your listeners is that what these three individuals have done is to expose what the U.S. government is doing calling in the name of national security or whatever considers important, fighting the war on terrorism, is really masking the goals of political and economic elites, what their interests are nationally, and certainly what the Egypt issue is going to continually bring out, their interests overseas. But that in the name of national security, we see by what these individuals have brought to the surface, they are seeking to place security over speech and dissent. A very dangerous precedent, need I say. Finally, tying these three people together, they are bringing to light this national security state which can only function through deception and excessive secrecy to carry out repressive measures in domestic and overseas setting. And they have provided what I would call overall the most basic service to democracy, and that they have exposed state crimes hidden from view.
Yes, indeed. There's no question about that. Again, this is so worrisome, Andrew. The worst of what goes on, and I'm really on these issues all the time. I've written so many articles on this, whether things going on domestically, which really are horrific, and they go back, they predate the Bush administration, but they got so bad after 9/11, and Obama literally replicates the worst of George Bush, and he exceeds in so many ways the worst of the Bush administration policies, with waging war on whistleblowers, silencing dissent, waging multiple direct and proxy wars, doing all kinds of, enforcing all kinds of harsh measures at home. And I can only imagine what the next 3.5 years will be. The worst of what's gone on so far, it simply is accelerating. It's getting worse on this. And Obama, despite all the harm he's done to so many people just domestically at home, he's still got half the country supporting him. I haven't seen a poll in at least the last week or 10 days, and the last one I saw was about the lowest he's been in maybe a year or 2 years, but it was only marginally below 50%. Maybe it was 46, 47%. I can't imagine more than 20 or 25% of the country supporting him, the loyalists who just don't back off no matter what. But this guy really is a wrecker. He's a human wrecker. He's destroying freedom at home. He's doing all he can to advance America's imperium abroad, and with the spying and everything else, it really is a very, very serious situation. And most people, even though they know, Andrew, that NSA is involved in spying and maybe they're vulnerable, they go along with their daily lives like, oh, well, you know, they're not bothering me, so I'll worry about other things. And this missiveness lets these people literally get away with murder.
Sure. Let me elaborate a bit on what you're bringing, which is some excellent points. I think I still want to, again, say that there may be, within all these negative developments, some possibly positive results. But let's go back to what you're saying and talk about that. Yes, the growth and further development of the national security state has ramped up during the Obama administration. Need I say this incredible proliferation of drones now domestically, where we're all going to be watched from the skies. The need I say on the state and local level, and there's been a lot written about this, I'm sure you're aware of the militarization of the police, that they're heavily armed and primarily, if you look at the evolution of the SWAT from the 70s to the present, they're primarily being employed against dissenters. You know, they're being met with this, like, incredible armed force to spread fear and to hit them over the head. So with the police, with the NSA, with the drones, what does it come down to? We live in fear. We are all suspects. But, again, let me just say one thing, which, again, leads me to seek to lean that there could be something positive, who knows when. I would not dare take out my political crystal ball. But the American people may be going along because they don't yet see a viable alternative. And I think if something would develop that there is a viable alternative movement or some challenge to the control of political and economic institutions, the American people would, I would dare say, and there's some evidence of this, would be on board and would be quite progressive. Now, as for, again, the passivity, which you're very correct in pointing out, I would urge your readers, and I don't necessarily like to just throw out books for the sake of throwing out books, but one could look at, there's a certain what I would call social psychology to going along, why we go through these humiliating procedures at the airports, why we are accepting the drones, why some of us are going along with NSA and want to kind of somewhat bury our heads in the sand. I would urge your listeners to take a look at a very interesting book written some time ago by Eric Fromm. His last name is spelled F-R-O-M-M. The title of the book is called Escape from Freedom. In a sense, I feel that that is what is characterizing some of our discussion here today about political events inside and outside the United States. In essence, Fromm was talking about how he wants to answer the question, how fascism developed in Nazi Germany. Why did the German people go along and contribute to the rise of Hitler and the Nazi Party? And I see some of this in the United States. In a sense, what Fromm kind of develops in a nutshell is that people gave up their freedom. They surrendered it. They submitted. There was a willingness to give to a higher authority because freedom became too much of a burden. And I see that in the United States. In that sense, that's why I think what Eric Fromm said in Escape from Freedom is applicable here.
Oh, it really is so. Things are so different now, Andrew, than back in a little bit, to some extent in the 1950s, not a great deal, but mainly in the 1960s and early 1970s. The thing that strikes me so much is back then, people did not have the technology they have today. There were no computers, no home computers. I saw the first computer at the University of Pennsylvania, the INOWAC, if I'm pronouncing it right, the INOWAC. I was actually in the room with this monster machine with thousands and thousands of lights blinking. I forget how I was taken in there, but I was, and there were technicians all over the place. And the power of that computer doesn't even match the laptop, not the laptop, but the desktop I have and do all my writing on and my online work and so on. So this little thing I literally could pick up and hold in my hands. It's not that light, but I could pick it up and hold it compared to that monster. But people then had none of the technology. There was nothing online. Getting informed meant I forget how much news there was on TV then. There was no cable channels. I remember TV news when it was 15 minutes a day on maybe one or two channels. John Cameron Swayze, I remember so much. But on radio, the usual ones on radio my dad used to listen to before we got a TV set. But to now it's so simple. You can go online and you can get informed so easily. And do people do it? If they do it, do they pay any attention to it? Do they care? Do they spend any amount of time? I think they're more concerned about their daily lives. And their daily lives are important, but their welfare overall is the most important thing. And if they simply worry about one part of it and ignore the rest, they're going to wake up one day and find out that the things they value most are gone. And again, today they have every opportunity to know what's happening compared to the 60s and early 70s with the civil rights struggles, the anti-Vietnam War protests. And these things just went on month after month after month, and there's none of this now. There was a little bit after leading up to the 2003 Iraq War, but it faded. It's practically non-existent now. And the only thing close to activism are things like Occupy Wall Street, but even that's faded a little bit. I'd like to see that come back in greater force. It's still around, but it's not doing what it did when it began in its early months. And I've been out to Chicago Wall Street protests, and people seem very dedicated. I'm not sure where they are now. I'm not sure what they're doing. But this just isn't happening, Andrew. And unless it does, then the people who run this government can literally do what they want with impunity. And as far as things overseas, Andrew, people may care a little bit about what goes on at home, although they don't seem to be very much worried about spying, but they literally pay very, very little, if any, attention to the imperial wars abroad. You could stop people on the street of Chicago at random, ask them about Syria or violence in Iraq or other disruptive things going on in the Middle East, and they would probably look at you with a blank stare.
But boy, there's a lot to elaborate upon. Let me comment upon some of that. starting with the technology, I see technology as cutting both ways, that technology can oppress people, but it could also can liberate. You could use drones to spy on people. You could use the NSA to poke around in your emails and your computer. But it can also liberate. If you look at the Arab Spring, again, getting back to Egypt, it was the use of technology that helped spread that movement. So, again, it's a question of what kind of social usage is there for the technology, and it raises, to me, the, you know, the $64,000 question of who controls the technology. See, I wouldn't just condemn technology per se. The question then to ask as follow-up is your technology in private or public hands? To me, that's the problem. The technology is in private hands. It's corporate control. They are using technology basically to sell products. I always tell my students when I talk about technology, what are those cell phones, all those devices to get you to buy stuff? And it's a profit. It's for, you know, the capitalist, you know, consumption in a capitalist economy. But let me talk about the other thing which you mentioned, which to me is also very important. I do think sometimes it may go under the political radar, but there are some long-term effects to certain things that have happened in U.S. history, recent history, that have had its effect. And let me just get to one example of that in this kind of way. See, I find the fact that what these three individuals have done, Manning, Snowden, and Assange with WikiLeaks, point to the deception of the U.S. government, the secrecy. Now, you got to ask yourself, why is the U.S. government so obsessed with secrecy? Because they know they couldn't do these things. The American people would not accept a lot of the policies if it was all out in the open for discussion. And that's positive. Now, if you look at something else, which is also positive and takes us back, of course, to U.S. foreign policy, U.S. foreign policy has changed in response because people did take to the streets, because people did demonstrate over the Vietnam War. And now there's a skittishness to commit the U.S. military long-term and commit the incredible number of troops and monies because they know, if I can use, you know, the term Vietnam syndrome, it's not workable. So, again, there's been a kind of, it's not maybe as far as we would like, and we may be impatient with the scope of change, but change happens very slowly. And the example of Vietnam, it to me is very illustrative of what can happen when U.S. policies become what I would call increasingly dysfunctional.
Oh, so dysfunctional and getting worse all the time. I'm old enough to have some perspective, Andrew, going back a long, long way. I remember the 1930s vaguely, not too very well, but vaguely at the end of the 1930s, nothing earlier than that. I honestly don't remember the day World War II began, but of course it wasn't World War II at the time when Hitler invaded Poland. I mean, one country invading another doesn't mean the start of a global war, so who knew what would happen? And then there was a long interim before Pearl Harbor and in between, Germany attacked France. So it was along what they call the Zitzkrieg, where nothing really happened for a long time, and then all hell broke loose. And Roosevelt really wanted to get into the war long before it happened. He was very actively supporting Britain, and he literally forced the Japanese to attack at Pearl Harbor. Didn't warn the commander. Bingo. December 7th, America was in the war. I don't remember hearing his address to Congress on that day. I'm sure it was broadcast on radio. It must have been during the. I think it was on a Monday after the Sunday that Pearl Harbor was attacked, and I don't know what time of day it was. I could check, but I know I didn't hear. We had radio in those days, and if it was during the daytime, then it was on a Monday. I was probably in school, so I never would have heard it. But we got into the war, and I was too young to really understand what was happening. But it did happen, and there's a possibility that we really could get into another global conflict today. The way things are heading, I wouldn't be surprised. And the weapons around today make the ones available in World War II look like toys, except at the very end when the nuclear bombs were used for no reason at all, because the Japanese wanted to surrender and try to surrender months before, and the lies that have proliferated, including a little clip I saw on a channel on a program about the end of World War II, claiming the Japanese refused to surrender. The hell they refused to surrender. The only thing they wanted was to keep the emperor, and of course they got to keep the emperor.
Oh, yes. but maybe it's just I want to look at the upside of some of this, and I agree with everything you're saying. But I also want to add that I think it's important to look at oppression, which obviously this government has been doing a lot of that. It's inherently dysfunctional. It's dysfunctional in the long run because it tends to break down. And again, in regimes that seem to be so all-powerful, they tend to manifest an incredible amount of oppression prior to them collapsing. And again, without getting into all the examples, this has been pretty much an historical pattern. And again, not to feel have some historical Pollyanna, if you look around the globe, and historically, all oppressive regimes that one could name, they eventually crumble. All the empires that one could rattle off, they're gone. The Spanish, the Dutch, the Roman, the Turkish, and I dare say the American Empire, they'll crumble. It is just inevitable that to maintain empires, to maintain a large standing military globally, and a lot of these empires crumbled from within, because the course of maintaining an empire, look at even the British, they were smart as far as I'm concerned. They said, I had enough of empire, let's take care of the domestic needs. But all the others that didn't, they crumbled internally. Certainly it was the case, I would say, the classic case with the Romans. They overextend. We are overextended. And I say sooner or later, when an empire like the United States overextends, it's going to start to crumble, which I do see signs. I do see signs.
Oh, it really is. Every empire in history has gone down eventually, and America will be no exception. I guess the last one was the Soviet Union, but America may be the next one in line. It took the Roman Empire a few centuries to go down. Mm-hmm. Things happened in time-lapse photography today. Mm-hmm. Andrew, there's no question that America will have its denouement at some time. My concern is whether it'll take humanity down with it. Can I use the last couple of moments just to make a quick comment?
Sure.
On Tuesday, a very unmomentous event occurs. Al Jazeera America will debut. Mm-hmm. And I have an article that I'll put out tomorrow. Al Jazeera, the main Al Jazeera, is literally a shadow of its origination. It's a propaganda service. It's owned and controlled by the Qatari monarchy. Mm-hmm. The Qatari officials, including members of the royal family, are the chairman, the executive director, and they have a management consultant acting as CEO of Al Jazeera America. He knows nothing about journalism. I think he's an MBA, but certainly he knows nothing about journalism. And in the strategy discussions, they decided that they would not even replicate the type of programming that Al Jazeera Arabic and Al Jazeera English air. They will basically clone CNN and Fox News.
Mm.
Can you imagine another CNN and Fox News, Andrew?
No.
Well, that's exactly what's going to debut on Tuesday, August 20th. I urge listeners, stay away. Opt out.
Yeah, I agree. The concentration of the media in fewer and fewer hands, yes.
Oh, absolutely. I heard a little thing on TV just very briefly. CNN had a little clip on a program this morning about is there room for another cable channel? The viewers. Well, I wish they basically another cable news channel. I wish there was only one. Well,
yeah.
There is. Russia Today. I get Russia Today online. And anybody online can get Russia Today. They can get Press TV. They can get legitimate news. They can get the Progressive Radio News Network. They can get this program. They can get lots of alternative sources. They can get real news information and analysis. Why would anybody waste their time with CNN or Fox or Al Jazeera America or BBC or the other propaganda services? Because that's exactly what Al Jazeera plans. That's what they do abroad. They're going to do it in America. But they're going to dumb it down for a U.S. audience, so it'll be just as wretched as CNN and Fox News and the rest of them. I had to get that in.
Oh, it's okay. It's fine. In spite of what you see, it's supposed to be all this incredible diversity. Look at I'm sure you're well aware of this, the corporate coverage. It's the same. Even
it's
if you
same,
think
Andrew,
you're going
really
from CNN
is.
To Fox, It's pretty the same. I call MSNBC the Democrat channel, and I call Fox the Republican channel. But either way, they're just defending one version of the tweet.
You mean the same? I've got to get off. The good news is they're losing viewership. People are wising up and tuning out. I advise everybody to tune out. Why waste your time with junk and propaganda? Manage news. Get the real thing. PRN, the rest of them. Thanks, Andrew. I look forward to having you back.
I do, too. Thank you.
Join us next week, Friday, 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Weekends, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.